I'm Jamie Doyle, and I'm the sound engineer on today's Mooney Goes Wild.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, Director of the Botanic Gardens, Dr. Matthew Jebb, tells us about the oak processionary moth, the very latest tree pest to arrive in Ireland. Richard Collins talks with author James Morrissey about his book, The Bee's Knees. And I learn a lot about kiwis from a New Zealand conservationist spending her summer months in lockdown on Rockabill.
They are nocturnal birds. They're flightless, but they're actually really interesting because a lot of their features are actually mammalian. So they have really low body temperature, more like humans. So they sit at 36, 37 degrees, whereas most birds, like the terns out here on Rockabill, sit at 38 or 39 degrees. And they also have one of the largest egg to body ratios out of all the birds in the world. Their egg that they lay sometimes up to two in a couple of weeks, it's about 20% of their body size. So it's the equivalent to us giving birth to a 4-year-old.
Oh my goodness, it's incredible.
So, a very busy programme as always ahead of us. You can text 51551 or email mooney@rte.ie. In studio today, Niall Hatch with his Birdwatch Ireland hat on his head, Dr. Matthew Jebb from the Botanic Gardens, and Éanann Ealaíne. But I'm sure you heard the news today about the brown booby, which has sadly died after it first appeared on our shores off the coast of Greystones in County Wicklow last Monday. Well, Terry Flanagan has more on this story. Earlier today, he was at the Kildare Animal Foundation and he's just sent us this report.
Yes, Derek, I'm down here in County Kildare on what really is a very sad day, not just for the bird itself, but also for those people who've cared for it here in the Kildare Animal Foundation, and none more so than Dan Donoher. Dan, go through the last week for us, please.
We've had a roller coaster of a week. On Tuesday night, we got a call about the brown booby being lifted from the beach, and he was in a sorry state. So he went to local vets in Clucool, and they looked after him till we were able to arrange our volunteers to go and collect him. And then they transported him down to Kildare, where I met the volunteer at My Knife Vet in Kildare Town, and they're an emergency service so that we use it a lot, and we brought him in there and we were able to examine the bird, quite weak and exhausted, underweight, and we established he was a third of his body weight.
A third of his body weight. What body weight should he be?
So they're roughly around 1300, 1400 grams. Yeah, he'd lost a lot of weight on his travels to Ireland, and then on the few days that he spent here before being lifted.
And anything else apart from the loss of weight, what did you notice?
Quite sleepy, wanting to tuck his head under his wings, and that's a sign that birds aren't feeling well and quite fluffed up. So that, but other than that, feathered condition and stuff was quite good. His eyes were very good, so we couldn't find anything else physically wrong. But
so what did you do initially?
So we got the bird onto fluids and got him warmed up. And then after that, a few hours later in the vets, they gave him some high-calorie food. And that was done by tube into his stomach. And then they kept him stable overnight before we went to collect him the next morning.
And when you collected him, what condition was he in then?
Pretty much the same condition, wanted to sleep, but quite warmed up and did feel more hydrated. So we got back to the shelter where we had some specialised housing that we use for seabirds. It's a net bottom cage. We had a heat lamp set up, gave him more fluids and let him rest then. And then we worked with the vets to have a treatment plan. So every 4 hours we gave him fluids or some food.
So that first day, in what kind of condition was he?
Good, as I said, he was stable as we thought as he could be, but again, sleeping under the heat lamp.
Were you concerned at that time?
I was concerned, but as with all the animals that come into our care, we're kind of optimistic all the time because you have to be in this. We go through so many animals and they're sick and stuff, and you have to have that hope.
Was there any sign of infection?
No sign of infection. Feces and stuff was normal. No unusual smells or anything.
Now, when you say normal, how can you compare to normal? Because we don't come across boobies. What's the closest to a bird like this would be probably something like a gannet.
Yeah, gannets, and they're quite like gannets. So we were comparing it to that, really.
And how it was normal.
It was normal. Yeah, no bad smell, no kind of blood in the feces or anything like that. So we were comparing it to other seabirds that we deal with all the time.
So that was Wednesday and Thursday, and things were looking good, yeah?
Yeah, on Thursday morning we weighed him again and had put up some weight overnight, so that was really a good sign. And then we continued. He hadn't perked up as such in that time, but again, we weren't too worried. It can take a few days before they can start showing them signs. Then late on Thursday night, I went to tube feed him again. I noticed he just wasn't as strong as he had been throughout the day. So
what about his temperature and things like that?
Temperature had been normal at that time when I checked. On the Thursday, it started to go down when we checked again, and breathing started to become a bit more heavier as well. So
you became concerned more so on Thursday evening?
Quite concerned at that stage, yes. And the deterioration happened very quickly, and within probably half an hour, the bird had passed away.
That must have been a real killer blow for all of you here at the centre.
It was. We're good at it. And when we lose an animal, you know, we're always kind of sad by it. And we really, really tried with this guy. But we know, you know, we consulted with all the experts, all the vets we could, and then all the experience that we had. So we put absolutely everything into him. And we know, although we're sad, we're content with how we approached it and how we dealt with it.
And what will happen to the animal now?
The bird has been handed back to National Parks and Wildlife Service, and they are going to further investigate the cause of death. And
probably an autopsy, yeah?
Yeah, indeed, and see if there's any signs of microplastics or parasites as well. So that could be...
Oh, so you think then it may not have been just exhaustion, but there may be some other cause like plastics?
Exactly, yeah. So there could have been a reason, an underlying condition there, and that's what brought him to the shores in the first place, and that's why he deteriorated so quickly on the beach.
And after the autopsy, what do you think will happen to the bird then?
It'd be great to see him in the National History Museum, but again, that's up to National Parks, but I think that might be the way to go.
So that we might take him back here, have him stuffed and put on display as an educational model?
Exactly, yeah, the first one to be found in Ireland, so it would be really good.
Certainly would. I didn't get a chance to see it in the flesh, so to speak, myself. I did see the news reports. One person did say to me, Niall Hatch, that there was a bit of a media circus down there, and this media circus was attracting an awful lot of people, and these people were causing undue stress on the animal. Would you agree with that?
I don't know about that. Certainly there were a lot of people very interested in the bird. So it first arrived on, well, first seen on Monday afternoon. I live in Greystone, so I saw quite a bit of it. And down there on the beach, it was actually coming up to people. So that was a nice day on Monday. There were a lot of people there who were sunbathing, who were swimming in the sea, and this bird seemed to actively seek out human company, which was quite interesting. The word got out and obviously birdwatchers travelled to see it, but at that stage the bird had relocated to rocks close to the harbour in Greystones, where it seemed to be, it might have been tired, but it was sort of resting on the rocks for a couple of hours. Quite distant at that stage, people with long lenses were getting good photographs of it, but it wasn't causing any distress to the bird. Then that evening it relocated back down to the rock armour just off Greystones harbour wall itself, and again it didn't seem to be harassed by people at that stage. I know the next day it had returned to its original spot on the beach. That's when the 6-1 News filmed their report when the bird was down the beach. There were a few bird watchers around. That's the last time I saw it, but it apparently went back up towards the harbour later that day, towards the rocks there, and in the evening was seen to be in difficulty. So normally when you see very close photographs of birds, yeah, often that does cause harassment, but this bird actually was actively seeking out humans. It seemed to want human company. This species is known for that. The name Booby meant originally a foolish person or an idiot, because early sailors knew that they could just pick these birds up and kill them and eat them. It had no fear of man. Certainly when it was on the beach, when I first saw it, there was even a dog coming up to it. It had no fear of the dog. And I don't think that's because it was sick necessarily, as it subsequently transpired. It seemed to be behaving quite normally at that stage. I think it's just that they really don't have much fear of predators. Another thing I was thinking as well, obviously the bird was very hungry. It seemed to be about 500 grams underweight. So it was hungry. And maybe it was seeking out humans from the point of view of looking for food, because I've certainly seen this species before in the West Indies, where fishermen would often be gutting fish. They'd be throwing the scraps up and the boobies would come in and take that. So it may have associated humans with food. Okay. And that may be what it was looking for. So I think, you know, people do have to be careful careful, and we need a lot of, you know, ethical photography can be an issue. But in this case, I don't think the bird was.
But you see it as, sorry, Aine, just for one second. Yeah. But you see this as a great ambassador for birds,
absolutely,
don't you? I mean, we don't want to discourage people from going to view birds, but you must be really careful when a rare bird, particularly a rare bird like this, arrives on our shores. You shouldn't get too close. You should always be mindful of them. But at the same time, you kind of want to tell them about it because it's good for bird life and it's good for our understanding, actually, of global warming in this occasion and the sea temperatures rising.
Yes, this is a tropical species. It should really be in the tropical Atlantic. So to get one coming this far north, it's really very, very unusual indeed. And it subsequently transpired that what seems to have been a second different brown booby was seen on the previous day on a fishing vessel that was about 160 kilometres south of County Cork. So it looks like there were a couple in Irish waters, which is very unusual. This isn't the first record in Irish waters. There was a record back in 2016 of a bird that landed on a fishing vessel just south of the Skellig Islands. And that same year, a dead, long decomposed corpse was found on the beach in County Cork as well. This is certainly the first one that's ever been seen from the mainland and the first one that people were able to see. But as you said, it has been a real great ambassador. People in Greystones particularly really took this bird to heart because it was so tame and confiding. And it also looks kind of comical. They have these enormous big yellow webbed feet.
Like it has welly boots on.
They look like welly boots. They do.
Was it fishing? Did it do any type of
it did.
Hunting for itself?
It did. I saw it certainly taking off from the beach a few times, diving into the water. They're very close related to gannets, as we heard. And what they do is, they rather than gannets, the way gannets dive, which they go in almost vertically into the water head first. Well, what happens with the brown boobies is they go at an angle, do a shallow dive into the water. And I certainly saw it catching fish on a few occasions, quite small fish, but fish nonetheless. And it was certainly defecating so on the rock. So it was certainly eating some sort of nutrition and behaving relatively normally. And certainly on the Monday, there was no real cause for concern over its behaviour because we know this species is very tame, as I said. Certainly over the course of the day on Tuesday, it seemed to be deteriorating. So it looked like it wasn't getting the nutrition it needed. And it's obviously transpired.
And you're happy with the idea of it being stuffed and mounted at the Natural History Museum, if that's what happens?
Oh, I think that would be a really good idea. Absolutely. I think that this bird can be recorded now for posterity. We can learn a lot from it. And I think that finding out as well if things like microplastics played a role in its demise would be very important as well. We know that a lot of seabirds in Irish waters and all around the world have a real problem with plastics in their systems, as do fish and as do some of us humans now as well. Plastic is really, really polluting our food chain, and this bird is bringing attention to that.
Well, they've
done
a lot of work on that at UCL, haven't they, in Limerick? Matthews.
Well, one of the interesting distinctions about boobies and gannets is they've been put into the genus Morus, which to us botanists is a mulberry tree. So there's an unusual relationship sometimes between names of plants and animals. Another one is the blue butterfly is in the genus Pieris, which is a little shrub in the Ericaceae family. So that's an interesting.
That has nothing to do with the butterfly. It doesn't feed on it.
Well, it's a good.
Or anything.
No, not at all. Strange botanical link to.
I know another one
gannets.
Is Prunella, which is the dunnock and the eccentres, and I know that's a plant genus
as
well.
Yeah.
I think that the rule with genera is that they can't be shared in or repeated in the same kingdom, but
that's
actually,
right.
The different kingdoms they can.
Well, you think they get a few new words that they don't have to be copying the ones that exist. But it was in the Sulla family before it was changed, and that's one of the few words that comes from the Irish language. Sulla is Latin. Word, but it comes from Sewell, and gannets and boobies were in the Sulla family, and they have wonderful eyesight. So it's a great thing that the Irish language influenced the Latin language.
Well, actually, speaking of the eyesight, I wonder when gannets and when the likes of boobies dive, because they dive and they skim the water, you know. So, but when they're diving in, do they close their eyes when they hit the water, or what do they do? And if they close their eyes, how do they catch the fish?
Well, what a lot of birds have, well, all birds indeed have a thing called a nictitating membrane, and a lot of seabirds, it's like a third eyelid, and a lot of seabirds, it's transparent, so they can close it. So it's like wearing a pair of goggles, and I know. But certainly for some birds like cormorants, which are related to the gannets and the boobies, they're you know, relations of each other's, they actually use them almost like an extra lens, like spectacles, to correct their eyesight. The thing, of course, that gannets and boobies would have to do when they're diving in, they'd have to also correct for the way that the light bends, the refraction of the light under the water. So they're striking and aiming to sight an area where the fish appears to not be. You know, they're missing, they look like they're missing it, but they're deliberately doing that. And given that gannets and boobies go in at a different angle, they must compensate in a different way for the angle of the light. I think it's quite interesting.
And they also add, and they reinforce heads so they don't brain themselves and knock themselves out in the water.
That's right. And they're very streamlined beaks as well. The beak and the forehead, it's almost seamless, the joints. So they're very, very streamlined. And they can hit the water at, I think it can go over like 50 or 60 kilometres an hour face first. So it's quite
extraordinary stuff. Well, it's a sad day, the bird lovers and for people who are following this story. But well done and best of luck to everybody at the Kildare Animal Foundation, because they really did do their best. And Sheila O'Callaghan, who is our producer today, Sheila has popped in to give us some news on another related story. Sheila.
Well, during the programme last week, we were contacted by Anna in Castle Knock, who mentioned that she'd found a wood pigeon in her back garden while we were on air, actually. And it had an injured, what she thought, an injured wing. So I contacted the Kildare Animal Foundation and got to speak to Dan, and Dan immediately sent somebody over to Anna's house in Castle Knock. It was starting to get dark, but they did find the pigeon. Anna had put it into a box, and we got some really good news from Dan right now, actually. Some better news than we've had, sadly, with the booby. Yeah. So it was a young wood pigeon, and it's now doing extremely well. It's improved greatly over the past few days. It's responded well to rest and the medication, and it's in foster care in Dublin with one of the volunteers.
In foster care? Isn't that fantastic?
And the wonderful thing, because I have actually in the past done a few reports with the Kildare Animal Foundation, I actually went to Aidy McGee's house. She's one of the volunteers, and I've seen at first hand the kind of foster care that they give, which is absolutely amazing. It's so, well, obviously kind, but meticulous, and they do absolutely everything they can to ensure that the bird or animal, whatever,
gets the best chance of life.
Gets the best chance, yeah.
That's why they're so good at over the booby today.
And the wonderful thing is that they will re-release this pigeon back in Anna's garden in Castle Knock.
Well, actually, that was one of the question marks over the booby. If it had been looked after, or if it had survived, rather, would it have been repatriated? And do you throw it onto the prevailing winds and hope it finds its way back to where it came from?
We would go off the booby show personally to bring it to the Caribbean.
That's what happened, if you remember, with Leonardo, the turtle, way back when it washed up in Bannistrand, and Gabriel King, who's the turtle expert, and Don Conroy, who's the wildlife artist, and I went along for the ride, and that was brought to New York with Aer Lingus on board the 747. God, you'll never see another 747 again. They've stopped making them, or they're going to stop making them, and British Airways have retired theirs. And then was brought down to Port Aransas, and then the university took over there, and they were going to repatriate to that one stretch of beach in the Gulf of Mexico, Rancho Nuevo, where these turtles breed. Yeah. See, that's what would have had to have happened with this bridge. You'd have to physically bring it back. Well, anyway, it's all
it's a moot point at the moment, but of course. But the thing is that these birds, yes, releasing it into cold winter Irish waters, if it took several months to recover,
it wouldn't
survive that.
No.
The other thing, though, is they have quite a wide range in the tropical Atlantic, so we can't say for sure it came from the West Indies. It could have come from Costa Rica or Panama or Mexico, or indeed it could have come from West Africa or the Cape Verde Islands.
Yeah, but for sure, no, they didn't come from Bray.
No,
so it was some journey regardless.
Absolutely. Yeah. In those cases, obviously, it would be pointless to rehabilitate an animal over several months and then release it into unsuitable conditions.
But any warm place would have done, because the boobies aren't so endangered as the turtle
was. Yes, their conservation status globally is actually very favourable. They're doing well. Yeah.
Sheila?
So just to say thanks so much, Anna, if you're listening. And I know you are. And I know you do enjoy Mooney Goes Wild. Thanks for your very positive comments about the programme. And thanks for contacting us, and the pigeon's doing really well. So we're on 5-1, 5-5-1.
Happy days. Anyway, now a 50 mile, whatever that is in kilometres, would be about 70 80? Or 80 kilometres, 50 mile, 70, 80 kilometre wide swarm of flying ants has been making its way over the UK, and it's so huge that it has been spotted from space. Ain't it, you're
right? The man in the moon reported that he was looking down. What do you mean it was spotted from space? That's the big deal. Space probably sees you and me from the satellites going around. That wouldn't necessarily make any sense. But 50 mile or whatever many kilometres is, it's time of year for flying ants. This is what they do at this time of the year. They get up in the air, it's the mating season, they grow their wings, mammies, the queens get the wings, the drones get the wings, and it's sex and drugs and rock and roll up there. And it happens here in Ireland as well, and then they're food for the seagulls, they're food for the swifts, there's all sorts of, and they drop back down to earth when the deed is done. And of course, the men have had their crowded hour of glorious life, that's the end of them. And the females, when they come back down to earth, and if you're sitting on your veranda having a gin and tonic watching this, you can see them breaking off their wings. They actually break off their wings, go back in under the holes, and go into hibernation, because they live on the muscle, all the muscles that they needed for those wings. That gives them their nourishment, and next year they'll start up new nests. So it's an enormous amount of biomass, if you like, for the continuation of the species, because most of them don't make it between being eaten by something or not falling in the right place or falling into the sea or whatever. But it's every year they go on about it and so bad.
I know, I never remembered like this saying. I was watching the news the other night, I was watching the BBC news, and they showed the satellite images, and the Met Office had discovered this, you know, in the UK, the Met Office.
Thought it was raining.
And everybody was terrified and thought they were going to land on us and eat us all, like the locusts eating the plants or something. Anyway, it's not going to happen.
They were saying it was a plague. A plague is something that's going to damage. You get a plague of locusts to eat all your plants. The ants aren't going to do anything to us, and these black flying ants don't even sting.
Anyway, ducks are the answer to the plague of locusts, are they not? Didn't the Chinese move a whole army of ducks into some
ducks
part
have a voracious
China
appetite, yeah,
to eat the locusts? Because remember, that was only a few months ago, wasn't it?
They do with snails as well, because ducks like to eat snails.
Yes,
I've seen
and
that
then
in
when
Thailand
they
as well.
Eat the ducks, yeah. So it's a real.
They convert the locusts and the snails into eggs as well, which
very
is useful.
Good, yeah.
Controlling your pests with another creature or insect is always an excellent idea.
Yeah, it works.
In the Botanic Gardens, we do a lot of work with what we call integrated pest management. So you identify the plant pest you've got and you introduce the right beetle or wasp.
Yeah, but you have to make sure that it's the thing you're supposed to eat. Oh, yeah, and not that the cane toad.
It's become very sophisticated now. Once you've done that, it's pinpoint accuracy. It doesn't affect anything else and you don't use any chemicals. So it's a very beneficial method.
So we shouldn't be afraid of this big, bad
swarm. Not at all. No, go and observe it. Watch it. Watch them coming down. Watch them breaking off their wings. Watch them going underneath the ground again. Be amazed.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Anyway, and it's a very busy website. It's a terrific website with a very extensive archive going back 25 years. Now, Dr. Matthew Jebb of the Botanic Gardens wants to tell us all about the oak processionary moth, the very latest tree pest to arrive in Ireland. I feel I should just get out now. Anyway, off you go, Matthew.
I know. Derek, this is bad news that just 2 weeks ago we heard that the oak processionary moth had been introduced to Ireland. It didn't get here under its own steam. It arrived probably as eggs on the bark of imported oak trees. And these were planted in a park in South Dublin. And thankfully, a very alert person spotted this great nest of caterpillars. The caterpillars of this species are very unusual. The processionary word in its name means they parade in a procession. They all follow each other, all of the caterpillars.
Like elephants holding each other's tails.
That's right. They're very close together and they march around on the tree and they chomp into all of the leaves. They'll defoliate an entire branch and then they spend the night by weaving a sort of cocoon around all of the caterpillars to protect it. But the other thing that protects these caterpillars are very nasty little hairs. They're covered in little hairs that break off. If you disturb the nest, if a dog or a person disturbs the nest, they release these little hairs and they cause an intense asthmatic reaction or dermatitis on your skin. And when they've were first introduced into the UK in London, they appeared in 2005. It was a couple of years that they had been around this newly built housing project, and everybody there was suffering from skin rashes and so on. So the doctors couldn't understand what was causing all of these reactions in this single group of new homes. And then they realised the caterpillars of this moth had arrived again in the same way on oak trees.
But how was it getting into the house? Why was it going into the house?
It's not getting into the house. It's people walking about and literally standing under a tree, leaning on a tree. The caterpillars are releasing these little hairs and they drop onto your body. So
just,
it's
just the hairs, yeah.
It's a very
nasty. So obviously
nasty.
This COVID, when people are locked down, walking out in the park, were actually paying attention, looking at what they saw on the trees and saw these. What colour are they, Matthew?
They're sort of silvery grey, white, little black heads. But the thing to beware of is there is certain native moths that have very similar caterpillars that also weave little nests, but they don't behave in this processionary way. They don't follow the leader. So
just one behind the other, like in single file?
A single file or multiple. They're sometimes all lined up together, so it can be five or six caterpillars wide.
Yeah. And do birds eat them then? Do these hairs affect the birds that try to eat them
too? That is the problem. They don't. They don't. And now this is a Central European species, and what has been happening over the last 50 years, it has been migrating northwards. Again, it's it's a climate change comes into this story, because essentially these this species of moth has gradually been migrating northwards. As the summers have proved warmer, the winters more mild, the species has established further and further north, and it now lives across the southern Netherlands, where all the big tree-growing nurseries are. So importing trees from the continent literally imports the eggs of this caterpillar. So they arrived in the UK in 2005. They now cover an area probably in excess of 200 square kilometres around London. So the spread is phenomenal, and it's very upsetting for anybody who fancies trees. It's not just that the oak is being defoliated, but it will affect the entire ecosystem. Mm. So once they get out into oak forest...
They only eat oak.
They only eat oak, but they will, if hard pressed, they will go to sweet chestnut, birch. And
what
so
happened
on.
To these ones that were seen in this park in Dublin?
They were quickly destroyed, and you have to be very careful destroying them, because in doing that, you know, you have to, normally you would use sort of hair lacquer or some sort of varnish. You spray that on to fix the little hairs, and then one of the approved methods is a flamethrower, actually, just to
burn the tree down. I see. But then if they nothing eats them and they have no enemies, does this mean that nearly all those caterpillars will pupate into adults, into moths?
Certainly in these islands, they are at the moment. I mean, obviously they have predators down in Central Europe. So they would have little wasps that probably parasitise them, and there are probably species of bird that specialise in eating them. But once they're a novel creature like that in a new country, they really are released from all of those natural controls and they run amok.
And then the adult, is the adult anyway, I mean, it could be presumably the processionary moth, a brown sort of a thing, is it?
It's a very dull looking brown moth. Yeah. And you know, most of us would look at it and think, well, that's just a typical
another
moth.
Brown job,
but this is the latest in a great catalogue of tree pests and diseases that have been introduced over the years. And it's sort of tragic, you know, that we've had the ash dieback disease.
That's still on the go, isn't it?
It certainly is. Yeah. The horse chestnut leaf miner, that arrived 2013. So literally every year or two, something new arrives here. And it is not because of a natural progression. It is because they are being traded in.
Is there no quarantine against bringing in plants? Is there no, you know, these islands, are we not safe? Have we no plant security? I thought there was some rules about that. You can't bring anything in willy-nilly.
Well, you can and you can't. If you've got a passport to introduce plants, you're allowed to bring them
in. Come on, a passport.
It acts as a tracing system, so you know where those trees arrived. So they arrived in a big tree nursery here in Ireland and they were distributed, and this one was spotted in South Dublin.
So there could be others in that consignment.
Absolutely. And so everybody needs to be alert and look at recently planted small oaks in Parkland. The problem is, you know, planting a sort of oak tree that's several metres tall is unwise for that very reason, because very few of them are grown in this country.
Yeah, to get to that size, they have been brought in. And we have two species of oak in Ireland, the sessile oak and the pedunculate oak. Does this processionary moth attack them both, or is it confined its attention just to one of them?
No, it eats them both, because they are actually so closely related. Actually, the strange thing about sessile and pedunculate oaks is they have most of their genes in common.
So they can interbreed and
they hybridise.
Yeah.
It's like Billy Ho, yes.
Yeah, indeed.
So what's going to happen?
Keep your eyes open for hairy moths and tell somebody.
Keep your eyes open for the man what?
And tell somebody. Who do you tell?
Sure. He's telling us, but what can I do about it?
Who does the man in the park tell?
Department of Agriculture have got an alert system. So if you go onto their website, you'll see that they have a high priority on this species, because the only time you can control this thing is now. If we don't get a handle on it
before this winter, or...
very early next year, it will be too late. And, you know, there's more to come behind it. There is the pine processionary moth. There is the emerald ash borer.
All in a procession coming on.
There's a procession of these moths.
So if you see a hairy processionary moth,
flying ants,
you ring up the Department of Agriculture.
It's global trade. Global trade is, you know, the single biggest factor in this. We're moving living plants all over the world. historically, we did it with packets of seed, and very few pests move through that.
That's how we
root.
Got the white-toothed shrew. Mm-hmm. That came in the roots of somebody who wanted to plant a great big 20-foot tree to make their garden nice during the Celtic Tigers. Remember the Celtic Tiger?
Yeah.
How do you remember it now? But they did. And down to Tipperary, and there was the shrew doing its business for ages, and it was only discovered in the pellets of the kestrel that had been coughing up these pellets, because it's the white-toothed shrew, and our normal shrews, the pygmy shrew, has red teeth. And somebody going through the pellets found white teeth and said,
I don't want to say they must have had very little else to be doing. I can understand why they're going through the pellets, but imagine going through it and saying, no, that's a white tooth.
Well, we've got white tooth, yeah, but you see...
That's what researchers do.
The kestrels wouldn't be eating all that much, I mean, because we only have very few small mammals that kestrels can feed
on. I know, but imagine spotting it. What about attention to detail, Aine? Attention to detail.
Yeah,
anyway,
well.
you heard what Matthew said. So we have a picture on our website. Jarlath has put it up, rte.ie/Mooney.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Email mooney@rte.ie.
Now, let's go back to the year 1937.
Hello, playmates. And now, for no reason at all, I'm going to sing you a little song that made me famous. The song that I made famous. Well, anyway, one of us is very good, and I entitle it The Bee. Oh, what a glorious thing to be, a healthy, grown-up, busy, busy bee, filing away the passing hours, pinching all the pollen from the cauliflowers. I'd like to be a busy, busy bee, being just as busy as a bee can be, flying round the garden, the sweetest ever seen, taking back the honey to the dear old queen. Buzz, 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 honey bee, buzz, if you like, but don't sting me. Buzz, 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 honey bee, buzz, if you like, but don't sting me.
Do you remember the singer, Arthur Askey? I can picture him still. I'm not even that old. Small man, bald head, straw hat, and little round glasses like Woody Allen, and the happy, cheery voice. Anyway, why are we playing you that? Well, as you know, on Monday nights we delve into the Mooney Goes Wild archive to give you a second chance to hear some of our documentaries from the past 25 years. And tomorrow night, you get another chance to listen to a documentary about the late Philip McCabe, who was known to our listeners simply as The Bee Man, but he was more than that. In his role as president of APAMundi at the International Federation of Beekeepers Associations, Philip travelled the world talking to fellow beekeepers, farmers and world leaders, and he never missed an opportunity to promote the role of the honeybee in every aspect of the ecosystem. As you will hear in this extract from an address he made to the European Parliament.
Throughout history, ladies and gentlemen, humanity as we know it has suffered many setbacks. Droughts, wars, floods, fires and famines, some within and some outside of human control. Fundamentally, for us to survive on this planet, we need clean air and good food. However, we are now facing a new frontier, one that could have devastating effects on all of us. Our insects are facing extinction. And this is predominantly due to the extensive use of certain chemicals in farming practices. Over one third of all food produced in the world is pollinated, with insects being the major contributor to pollination. And 70% of all pollination is carried out by the humble honeybee. So without question, the honeybee's existence has a very direct effect on our own existence.
And you can hear that documentary featuring the late Philip McCabe tomorrow night on RT Radio 1 from 10 p.m. And sticking with apian matters, while bee populations, including our native honeybee, are in decline, lockdowns have seen reductions in a number of insect-harming practices like air pollution and pesticides, creating a friendlier environment, if you like, for wild bees. Conservationists hope this trend will continue, as bees are vital to our survival as they pollinate so much of the food we eat. And of course, there are a number of other benefits to having healthy bee populations. The Bee's Knees by James Morrissey is a new book which looks into the health benefits of honey, the amazing capacity of bees to communicate and navigate, and how some of the oldest laws governing bees and beekeeping originated in Ireland, as Richard Collins discovered when he spoke to James Morrissey.
Hello, James. In your interesting book, you trace the history of beekeeping. How far back does beekeeping go?
Well, bees have been around for a very long time. A bee that was found preserved in Myanmar, formerly Burma, is estimated to go back some 100 million years. And the Greeks were very familiar with bees and beekeeping, as were the Egyptians later on. And indeed, Egyptian leaders were embalmed and preserved in huge cases of honey, because honey is known as a preservative. It never deteriorates as long as it's in a sealed container.
Now, in Ireland, we had the Brehon Laws up to the beginning of the 17th century. Now, I believe there was a chapter within the Brehon Laws on keeping of bees.
Yes, they were called the Bee Judgments. They pertained to people who kept bees and how they had to mind their hives. And if, for example, bees settled on a branch of a tree in your garden and were clearly feeding off the nectar and the pollen in your garden, you were actually entitled to a percentage of that honey for up to 3 years. So the bee judgments were very clearly set out. And if somebody was unfortunate enough to be stung in the eye by a bee, they were entitled again to produce from the beekeeper who owned the hive. But if the person who was stung killed that bee, they were entitled to nothing.
Did the people back then, and indeed now, did they regard them, bees, as livestock? Or do they? It's rather like cats and dogs. You can own a dog, but you can live with the cat. You don't own it. Are bees rather like the cats, something that agrees to live close to you, and is actually not livestock? It's not a sheep or a cow or something. So if it damages somebody, stings somebody, you're not responsible.
No, but you would be expected to have and always have a level of diligence in keeping the bees. And calling people who keep bees, maybe we shouldn't be called beekeepers, but maybe we should be called bee assistants, in that we would help people to keep bees and mind bees, but that we don't really... they're not ours. We shouldn't really say that we own them. I think we should help them in the habitat, and that really should be our role. I don't think we should have that proprietorial role.
You're a contributor, Father Simon Sleeman, who is kind of the Irish equivalent of Brother Adam, the famous Buckfast beekeeper. He says that. He says that the bees look after him just as much as he looked after them for 40 years. And he says they helped him through the ups and downs of life. Do you look at them like that too?
I do. I think it is a great honour and privilege to be in the company of bees, and to be able to assist them and encourage them and make the environment in the locality suitable for their existence. Because they're so important. 50% of all the foods we eat result from pollination. The bees can tell us an awful lot about how is the right way to conduct one's life. They are so selfless. They look for very little. They lead a very, very short life. One bee will produce about a tenth of a teaspoon of honey in her life, and she lives only about 8 weeks. They're so, so important. And I think my own experience was I started with a childhood fear of bees, and probably it developed into what I'd call an adult fascination. Maybe like a lot of things in life, the more I've learned about bees, every time I learn something new, I realise how little I know and how important they are and how really they shouldn't be just swatted away when they land on the windowsill or go near a jar of jam or whatever.
Now, in your book, you treat of the question of genuine honey. You say that a lot of stuff on sale is not genuine honey. It is mixed with something. I would have thought that mixing something with honey is probably more expensive than having the honey in the first place, or is it?
There's a global shortage of real honey, which means that a lot of Me Too type honeys are being sold, but they're not real honey. And people should look at the label and read the label. What you're really looking for is pure Irish honey.
Well, now, would you recommend people in cities, living in cities, to keep hives? Is that to be encouraged?
As long as the bees that you're caring for and nurturing are not a nuisance to neighbours, to people living nearby. But increasingly, they're discovering that the quality of honey from hives in cities is of an extremely high quality, simply because there's such a variety of flora and fauna. The flowers that you grow may be different to the ones that I grow. And for people to help bees, they don't have to become beekeepers as such. They can grow flowers in their garden that flower at different times of the year. And certainly, increasingly, people are encouraged not to cut their lawns to within an inch of their lives and maybe to leave a section of the garden occupied by wildflowers.
Thank you, James, and good luck with the book.
Richard, thank you very much.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Or you can text 51551. Last week we did a special programme on seabird colonies around our coast, and we featured the Rosie O'Tern colony with Stephen Newton and the wardens that are volunteering there for the summer on Rockabill, just off the coast of Skerries. And Stephen said, "You must come out." And I said, "I'm going out." And I went out on Tuesday and Wednesday. Was it Wednesday or Thursday? And I was out there for 2 days. And while I was there, I met two young conservationists who travel all the way from New Zealand. So I thought you might like to meet them.
Hi, my name is George Nicholas. I'm from Kapiti Coast, Wellington, New Zealand.
I'm Christy Owens, and I'm from Whakatane, New Zealand.
What's it called?
Whakatane.
How do you spell that?
Whakatane.
Oh, excuse me. All right, great. Okay, so tell me about you two guys. How did you end up here on Rockabill?
We worked in conservation in New Zealand, and we really wanted to go overseas, but we couldn't afford to travel for a year like we wanted to. So we thought we'd have a go at getting some conservation jobs. And we decided to choose Ireland because we could speak English, and it was a bit less scary than the rest of Europe. And Birdwatch had some amazing jobs going on Rockabill Island, so we decided to apply for them. And we somehow got them, probably thanks to COVID-19. There wasn't a possibility to do any interviews. We just sort of got thrown out here. So worked out pretty well.
Now, you said you worked in conservation back in New Zealand. What kind of work were you doing there?
I was working with Kiwi in New Zealand. You might have heard of them before. They're pretty famous. We even call ourselves the people from New Zealand Kiwis. I was working on a breeding program there, so we were just raising them until they were big enough to fight off predators and then releasing them back into the wild.
And where exactly was that?
That was in the Hawke's Bay at a place called Cape Sanctuary.
I think I've heard of a wine called Hawke's Bay.
There's a few wines there. We lived in amongst the wineries, so within walking distance from our house we had about 5 wineries. So on Sundays we would just go walk around and get a few tastings. So it was a pretty nice way to live.
And what can you tell me about kiwis? I know they're nocturnal birds, but that's pretty much where it begins and ends for me. I don't know anything else about them.
They are nocturnal birds. They're flightless, but they're actually really interesting because a lot of their features are actually mammalian. So they have really low body temperature, more like humans. So they sit at 36, 37 degrees, whereas most birds, like the terns out here on Rockabill, sit at 38 or 39 degrees. So really low body temperature for a bird. They're one of the few birds that actually have marrow inside their bones. They've got really thick legs, so really strong legs, and tiny little wings that don't do anything for them. They're just sort of left over from evolution. They also have a really long bill, but they're the only birds to have the nostrils of the bill right at the tip of their nose. They're pretty unique in that way. And they also have one of the largest egg-to-body ratios out of all the birds in the world. Their egg that they lay sometimes up to 2 in a couple of weeks, it's about 20% of their body size. So it's the equivalent to us giving birth to a 4-year-old.
Oh my goodness, it's incredible, isn't it? It really
yeah,
is.
It's,
and are they critically endangered or are they doing okay?
So there's 5 species of kiwi, and there are 2 that were critically endangered until a couple of years ago, and they're actually only nationally vulnerable now, which is the next step below critically endangered. But they all are, all 5 species are somewhat endangered, but they are trending upward on the conservation scale. There's lots of breeding programs in New Zealand that are working really well for them.
It is the national bird of New Zealand.
Exactly. We have to look after them, otherwise it would be a pretty sad story if kiwis lost all the kiwi.
So it's the silver fern, which is your national plant, as I understand it. Well, it's certainly the emblem that appears on the All Blacks jersey, the silver fern, and you've got the kiwi.
Yeah.
You've got it all.
Got it all, don't we?
And still you came to Ireland. Anyway, George, your turn. So Chrissy said there, you came to Ireland and Birdwatch gave you the jobs and a happy out. You think you might have got it because of COVID. You weren't just in Ireland. You didn't come all this way just to have a look at conservation measures here in Ireland looking after Rosie at Terns on Rockabill Island, did you?
We were at a pig rescue for quite a while, for about a month. And during that month, we applied for this job. And about 3 conversations later, we were out here.
Now, tell me how you found the jobs. Where did you start looking?
We work in conservation back in New Zealand, so we're on a lot of conservation websites. There's actually some incredible jobs going around the world for people with the right kind of experience. And most of that experience is living in remote, isolated places in interesting conditions. Mm-hmm. So we just jumped on a website and found it.
What was the website for people at home who might be interested in doing something similar?
conservationcareers.com, and one really good one for the UK and Ireland, Green Jobs.
Why do you do it?
For the right person, it's the best job in the world. You get to work with these incredible animals, have a lot of fun doing it, and hopefully make a difference.
Indeed, they do make a difference. So hello to Christy and to George, who are listening now on Rockabill. They're listening out there. What a wonderful 2 days we spent out there. You've been out there a million times, I'm sure.
Not quite a million, but many times. I really do like it. And hearing the sound of the terns in the background for that whole report is really evocative for me. They really are noisy.
Did they bomb you, Derek?
They did bomb me. They dive bomb me on my head, and I had my hat on and I had some cardboard between my head and the hat. So when they came down, but they do, they've got really sharp beaks and they just want to keep you away from the eggs.
And I
always
say,
you go on the island, there's eggs everywhere.
Oh, everywhere. And the terns, they defend themselves using both ends, shall we say. So you don't wear your best clothes either.
And one of the intriguing things, like Christy was saying now, the kiwi producing the biggest egg for its body size. The bird that produces the smallest egg for its body size is hugely unexpected. It's the ostrich.
The ostrich?
Which produces the biggest egg in the world, actually.
But it's a huge egg, but it's the smallest compared to the
size
mother
of the
bird
ostrich.
That has produced it, yes.
The size of the what?
The size of the ostrich. I don't even say what I thought I said. Because it doesn't sound as if we want to be repeated.
But incredibly, they're related. The kiwi and the ostrich are actually in the same family of birds. So this group of birds dispersed all around the world, and all of their descendants have become flightless.
There you go. That's the way of the world. Matthew, thank you very much indeed. The Botanic Gardens is open.
It certainly is. It's still a wonderful place to escape the tiresomeness of the lockdown.
And the one-way system in place. Matthew Jebb, thank you very much indeed. Enid, thank you. Niall Hatch, thank you indeed. On sound, as you heard at the very top of the programme, our sound engineer is Jamie Doyle. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our researcher is John Riley. And in studio today with me was Sheila O'Callaghan. We'll do it all again next week. rte.ie/mini. Until then, bye!
Visit the website rte.ie/mooney.